move to the seventh case for this morning, Wilkins versus River Edge Hospital.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andy Hale. I represent the appellant, Sir Ezell Wilkins. This case is before the court on the granting of the defendant, River Edge Hospital's motion for summary judgment. We believe that Mr. Wilkins has raised genuine issues of material fact that River Edge Hospital did indeed discriminate against him based on his sex. I know my time is limited. I'd like to briefly touch on three issues if I can, which is the first being, under the direct method of proof, whether Ms. Shemrosky's bias tainted the ultimate decision to terminate Mr. Wilkins, whether on the indirect method Mr. Wilkins and Ms. Dean were similarly situated, and third, whether the district court should have considered the fact that Mrs. Dean was not fired at the same time Mr. Wilkins was. If I could address the first issue, the district court found that there was no indication that Ms. Shemrosky, who he did find, Judge Shader said, there's no doubt that Shemrosky made numerous comments that could indicate a bias against men, but he went on to state that she didn't poison the well of the ultimate decision makers. And he talked about how that would not be the case if the decision makers relied even materially on what Shemrosky had to say.
But why does that show that that she was prejudiced against men? If she makes statements to the effect that I think a woman should be working with these girls who are disturbed and questions about bathing and massaging and things like that. When somebody expresses an opinion like that, why does that demonstrate that they're prejudiced against?
I think there's two answers to that. First, I think for some of her comments, it was simply a pretext, meaning that the patients needed assistance with bathing, for instance. What Mr. Wilkins testified to was these girls were 12 to 18 years old. It was a rare occurrence indeed, if ever, that a patient had to help bathing. These weren't toddlers. These were teenagers. So that's the first answer. Secondly, my understanding of the case law, and we cited this in our brief, is that the lack of discriminatory intent is not relevant. I mean, she didn't have to. She made these comments thinking in her own mind that there shouldn't be males. It doesn't matter whether she believed that is true or not. She, in her own mind, was not wanting to have males on the unit. It's improper for her to make hiring decisions based on that. So collectively, I think...
Well, I was just more as a general matter wondering if it's evidence of discrimination if you hold the belief that that women are better for working with disturbed young women.
Well, if you hold the belief that one gender is better than the other, that's still evidence of discrimination, even if you have a good faith belief that there's a basis for it. Otherwise, any employer could simply say, well, I think it's better to have just men. They might believe it, but the law doesn't provide for that. And Ms. Shemrosky,
the hospital had a policy of equal employment opportunity for both men and women with regard to any staff position.
Right. But here, the only person that looked into the matter was Ms. Shemrosky. She's the only person that did any kind of review. It was cursory because this was a reviewable offense. There were unusual circumstances on the night in question. She immediately decides to terminate, recommend that Mr. Wilkins get terminated. She's the only person that provides input to anybody. So the ultimate decision to terminate him all flows from her. Ms. Lindsay and Ms. Thomas, they didn't do any independent investigation. They relied on what Ms. Shemrosky said. Mr. Russell, who's the guy who they claimed was the executive staff member who had the ultimate authority, he doesn't even remember being involved and said, I don't even think I was involved. I might have been. He didn't do any investigation. So at the very least, Mr. Wilkins raised a genuine issue of material fact that Ms. Shemrosky's bias and her initial recommendation led to the well-being poison, so to speak, and to his termination.
Did she do some hiring?
She testified that she did hiring and firing of counselors. So there's even an issue, and I didn't have time to address this now, that she was the ultimate decision maker. I mean, that was a question of fact we put in our brief because she testified she had the authority to hire and fire counselors. Then she kind of backtracked off that. But based on her testimony, that was a disputed issue of fact of whether she could hire and fire herself. If I can move on to the indirect method of proof, what Judge Schrader found was that Mr. Wilkins and Ms. Dean were not similarly situated. He did find the first two prongs of the indirect method to be present. What I wanted to focus on was we believe Mr. Wilkins and Ms. Dean were identically situated. They had the same position, counselor, same supervisor, Chemerowski, and they did the exact same thing. They charted a patient as being present who wasn't.
Was the decision maker the same?
Well, the ultimate decision maker was not because of this review process, but our contention there is that if you look at the facts and the testimony, the review process were simply a rubber stamp of the initial recommendations. Let's talk about Mr. Wilkins. Mr. Barzilai, the CFO, he's just simply giving Mr. Wilkins a letter asking for a grievance right before the hearing starts. He doesn't know anything about anything. Karen Lindsay doesn't know anything about anything. Neither of them investigated anything. They simply listened. Well, that's not a review process. That's a rubber stamp if I ever saw it. Ms. Lindsay didn't even know that people lost their keys that night. That was in Mr. Wilkins' letter. She didn't even know that. And neither of them could offer any recollection of what was said at the hearing. And then for Ms. Dean, she was not, Ms. Chemerowski did not recommend she get terminated. So that she wasn't poisoned like Mr. Wilkins was. Mr. Russell, then, he's not faced with a situation where he's got an employee who Chemerowski recommended be terminated. And we contend the fact that she wasn't until 6 months later is a pretext for discrimination because there's an abundance of evidence that the hospital knew the very next day that Ms. Dean was involved. Dwayne Ross, another counselor, told Chemerowski that in November. Chemerowski even testified she told Mark Peart in the Human Resources Department in March or April. And then yet in May, on May 1st, River Edge writes a letter to the EEOC saying, we're still trying to find out if Dean worked the night of November 7th. That's incredible. They're claiming on May 1st, they don't even know if she worked the night in question. She signed the sheet of Dominique. And later they claimed, oh, we thought it was Kim Eggleston who didn't sign the sheet. We think those facts, at the very least, raise a genuine issue of material fact of a pretext for discrimination that she should have been fired just like Mr. Wilkins on November 7th. And on her review, Mr. Russell decides, oh, well, I think there's distinguishing factors here. And he goes through the three factors of how Mr. Wilkins discharged the patient, was supposed to separate the round sheet, which he testified he did, and then third, he did it more frequently. Well, if you take what River Edge is saying as true, which is that this is essentially a strict liability offense, is how Chemerowski testified, you have to eyeball the specific patient. If you don't, that's so important, you're gone. Dean did the exact same thing. So I don't think you can say her conduct's any differently than Mr. Wilkins. I see the lights on. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, unless there's any questions from your honors.
Thank you. Mr. King?
Good morning. It pleases the court, counsel. My name is Alan King. I represent the defendant, River Edge Hospital. The district court in this case found Mr. Wilkins' claims to be wholly empty and totally unsupported by the factual record. Obviously, we agree with that assessment. Starting with the direct method of proof, Mr. Wilkins does rest his entire case on pointing the finger at Ms. Chemerowski. However, as the district court found, Ms. Chemerowski did not make any of the relevant decisions in this case, and she certainly did not poison the decision makers. As the district court found, given that both Dean and Wilkins were terminated, really the only relevant analysis is at the rehire stage, and the record is absolutely undisputed that Ms. Chemerowski had nothing to do with either grievance hearing or either decision to rehire or not rehire, as the case may be. So clearly there's no evidence of any involvement whatsoever of Ms. Chemerowski. With respect to Mr. Wilkins' termination, there is also no evidence that she made the decision or poisoned the well. The most significant evidence, which counsel for obvious purposes leaves out, is the reality that before Wilkins was terminated, Ms. Thomas sat down with him, directly confronted him with this round sheet, and asked Mr. Wilkins, did you make these false entries? And he said yes. He freely admitted that he did. Ms. Thomas then asked, indicated, well, that's grounds for termination. And as Mr. Wilkins testified, what did you say? I didn't say anything. Most notably, he didn't say Sherry Dean also did that, or that I gave Ms. Shimrosky some note that we magically heard about later. So it is clear that Ms. Thomas directly confronted Mr. Wilkins with respect to his transgression. She made the decision. Both she and the HR manager, Karen Lindsay, were the two that conferred with Mr. Russell, the CEO, about the decision. Ms. Shimrosky was not a part of that conversation, was not a part of that phone call. So there's just no evidence that she impermissibly somehow tainted the well, if you will, on either of these decisions. And for that reason, these cat's paw and man-on-the-spot cases that counsel cites are easily distinguishable. I mean, those cases, the decision-makers have no independent knowledge of the plaintiff's transgression, and they're just deferring to the opinion of the supervisor. That's not the case here. Again, Ms. Thomas directly took the reins here. She confronted the situation. She sat down with Wilkins and asked him if he did it, and he admitted that he did it. So I would submit that those cases are easily distinguishable from this case. But turning to the indirect method, I think counsel misstates the district court in terms of the issue of the background circumstances. The court did not make a finding on that. And just very briefly, we don't believe that there's been a sufficient showing of the necessary background circumstances to indicate that River Edge was one of these extraordinary employers who discriminated against men. Both of the relevant decisions here, the rehire decisions, were made by men. And not surprisingly, there's no evidence of any anti-male animus there. The termination decision was made by Ms. Thomas, and the record is undisputed that she had no anti-male animus. And in fact, just the opposite. She made it clear that she thought having males on the unit was a good idea, and she wanted more. So based on that, even if you accept counsel's characterization of Ms. Shimrosky, the fact of the matter is Ms. Shimrosky, with no decision-making authority and no authority to terminate anyone, yelling in the wind, if you will, does not make background circumstances indicating that this is an extraordinary employer that discriminates against men. Further, counsel and plaintiff do rely exclusively on the dean comparison in an effort to try to satisfy both the similarly situated prong of the prima facie case and his pretext burden. And as the district court found, Dean and Wilkins were not similarly situated for at least two important reasons. Again, the rehire is really the relevant analysis and the relevant comparison. Those decisions were made by two different people, Mr. Barzilai for Mr. Wilkins and Mr. Russell for Ms. Dean. This court has indicated, and we've cited those cases, I think at page 28 of our brief, that when employment decisions on different employees are made by different decision makers, those employees are not similarly situated. Further, Mr. Russell did draw these three distinctions in his mind. He found the conduct to be different for those three reasons that have been enumerated, and the district court found that these were sound bases. And really all that Mr. Wilkins is asking this court to do, and what he asked the district court to do, was to second-guess Mr. Russell on those bases, or to act as a super personnel department and overrule his decision. And obviously this court has said time and time again that is not its function and not what it's going to do. And really, for those reasons, there's a Russell and Curry case that the plaintiff cites about the similarly situated prong. Those cases are easily distinguishable because in those cases there was no evidence of differentiating or mitigating factors between the plaintiffs or their comparators. And I think you'll find that to be true in those cases. Finally, with respect to the pretext decision or the pretext issue, with respect to the termination decision, Mr. Wilkins admitted, again, yes, I did it. He admitted his infraction. There's no dispute that the policy at River Edge is you have to actually see the patient before you mark their patient record, which he did not, as the patient was no longer in the building. So the reasons advanced by River Edge are not a lie. There's no issue as to whether they honestly believe those reasons, as they're not in dispute. And again, you know, try as he might or argue as he might, based on hearsay and circumstantial evidence that we knew earlier that Ms. Dean had also done this, the record just does not support that. The evidence does not support that we had that knowledge. And frankly, I think that's, in many respects, a red herring. Even if we had known Dean had done it earlier and terminated her earlier, we'd still have the same case, Your Honors. We'd still be here talking about the rehire of one and not the other. So I don't think that is a material fact. And in conclusion, you know, at the end of the day, the relevant decisions here, again, were the rehire decisions. They were both made by men. The termination decision of Mr. Wilkins was made by Thomas, who was an avowed, you know, person without an anti-male animus. The record is clear on that. So, again, the district court found these claims to be wholly empty, completely unsupported by the factual record, and we agree with that and would ask that you affirm that decision.
Thank you. 2 minutes, Mr. Young.
Okay, I'll be brief. Mr. Wilkins would not have been terminated without Ms. Shimrosky's recommendation. There's no doubt about that. Yet this is a woman who had allowed a female counselor in the prior year who made the same mistake to tear up the round sheet and didn't even, nobody even knew about it. She didn't even investigate what happened here. Here she rushed to judgment and recommended that Mr. Wilkins get terminated and passed that along to Ms. Thomas. And Ms. Thomas just went along with it. Ms. Thomas conducted no investigation, admitted she didn't know what Mr. Wilkins' initials looked like on the sheet. She didn't. She just asked him if he did it. Ms. Thomas just simply relying on what Shimrosky's telling her. Shimrosky had let a female get away with it in the past, but as soon as Wilkins did it, she had his termination papers written up the very next morning. No questions asked. The fact that Mr. Wilkins didn't tattle on Dean doesn't get River Edge off the hook for doing their own investigation. If anything, Dan should be complimented for that, not tattling on his co-worker. They say about the note, they indicate, tried to give you the indication that that's a lie. It's undisputed he did not sign Dominic's sheet at the bottom because he said he recognized his mistake. So that shows he recognized his mistake, which would support the fact that he left a note. And the decision makers, they said, had no independent knowledge in these other cases we cite. Here, the decision makers had no independent knowledge. Russell had no clue what happened. Barzilai had no clue what happened. Lindsay had no clue what happened. The only person who did any kind of a review, and it was cursory, was Shimrosky, and she was the one who decided that Wilkins needed to go. We think, at the very least, this is a summary judgment case. I don't know what a person in Mr. Wilkins' shoes has to show to survive summary judgment. It should have to be, we think the case should be remanded for trial on the merits. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is also taken.